Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast for May 10th, 2022. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host Bob Bupka. Bob, we have a big-time winner as our guest today, and the legendary head ball coach, Steve Spurrier. But we both would be remiss if we didn't chat for a bit about the most amazing winner that sports has seen in a very, very long time. Rich Strike, the 80-1 horse. Heck, the horse wasn't even supposed to be in the Derby. And then, Bob, it literally comes out of nowhere, down the stretch, stuns them all, wins the run for the Roses on Saturday. What a story.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm excited about being able to talk later on to Steve Spurrier. And I was trying to draw an analogy between Rich Strike on Saturday winning that Derby and, and Coach Spurrier. And what I thought was, you know, Steve Spurrier is getting ready at the University of Florida. They're going to play Florida State in their big game. And on Friday, the day before the game, Florida State has to drop out. But luckily, there's a Division III school nearby that has a football team. So right. They say, hey, would you guys like to go play against Florida? And they say yes. And that Division III school wins the game.
Yeah, it is. So, right. So Rich Strike gets in under the bell on Friday. And the story of the trainer is really something. Sonny Leone, the jockey, first time ever running. And what, I mean, whew, I'm still kind of stunned. When that overhead view that NBC Sports had was just spectacular to see. With that, what he did with that horse reminded me that what your scenario there with that Division III team, it reminds me a little bit of John Daly winning the 91 PGA Championship at Crooked Stick outside of Indianapolis. He was the ninth alternate. He drove all night to get to Crooked Stick, and then he went on to, you know, to arguably the most improbable major championship win in modern golf history, Bob. And I have a buddy, John Scheinman, longtime sports or horse race writer for the Washington Post. And I asked John to compare what Rich Strike pulled off at Churchill Downs to some previous sports upsets, if you will. He mentioned Buster Douglas taking down Mike Tyson, and I can see that. Johnny's a New Yorker, so of course he had to throw in the 69 Mets winning the World Series. And then he mentioned, in his opinion, perhaps the greatest horse race, horse of all, rather, Man of War. It only lost once in 21 starts, and the horse that it lost to in August of 1919 is the horse named Upset, which, interestingly enough, Upset, that term was actually used apparently in the late 1800s to speak to, you know, a surprise activity or surprise event. But I think those three are in that same vein as what Rich Strike pulled off.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And one added thing about John Daly's win, it's a great trivia question. There's only been one caddy in history that's carried the bag for a PGA champion, and he's done it with two different players. And that caddy's name is Squeaky Medlin. Yeah. He was the caddy for Nick Price. Nick Price had to withdraw from that that PGA Championship at Crooked Stick. Squeaky Medlin gets the bag. The following year, he's back on the bag for Nick Price. Nick Price wins the PGA Championship. So Squeaky lost his life very early to cancer, but he certainly was one of the great caddies out there. And I think it's a good opportunity on Musings to pay a little tribute to Squeaky Medlin.
I love that. And isn't that fascinating how that caddy player connection can work, Bob? I mean, in that situation, because Nick wasn't able to play, Daly asked Squeaky to caddy for him, and that was a big part. Let's say, no mistake, that's a big part of why John won.
Oh, no doubt about it. And unfortunately, it wasn't too long after that. And I was pretty close to Squeaky Medlin. And I got a call from him, and he was in the final stages, very final stages of suffering from cancer. And he called me and he said, you know, Bob, he said, I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. And I said, what's that, Squeak? And he said, please, you know, I'm not going to be here much longer, but after I go, make sure that you spread the word that, I had a wonderful life. I really enjoyed caddying, and I don't want anybody to be sorry for me. I want them to celebrate my life. And it wasn't but a few weeks after that that we lost Squeaky Medlin. Truly one of the great guys.
That's a great story. And obviously that was the kind of guy that he was. So for horse racing fans, we're on to the Preakness Stakes inside of 2 weeks at Pimlico outside of Baltimore. That will be most fascinating to see how Sonny Leone does with Rich Strike in that one. I have to tell you a quick story as we look ahead to Coach Spurrier. I'm an NFL guy. I grew up in the D.C. area, was a big Redskins fan back when they were a legitimate franchise. Not sure what they are anymore, so be it. But I was a college fan, so somewhat, but I didn't follow it with the passion that that you have in the SEC and so forth. So when Coach Spurrier took the Redskins job, and I was a statistician for their radio network, first time I ever flew on the team plane, I saw as we walked on the plane, they had the little tags on each seat in terms of who was supposed to sit where. And the first tag I see is HBC. And I had no idea what that meant. Had I been a longtime Gator fan, I clearly would have known that was head ball coach. And that's who he is. And that's how he's described himself for years. Loves to just pitch it and get the boys out there and pitch it around and catch it and let's get to it. So we're gonna have a lot of fun with him. I know you're looking forward to chatting with Coach.
Oh, I certainly am. And word has it on that plane that the seat that said HBC, the next one said KE.
Yes.
And I'm just assuming that was Kelly Elvin.
Keep on assuming. I'll keep on assuming as well. Hey, you know, we do have a whole lot to cover with Coach Spurrier. Among his many accomplishments, by the way, he's the only person to win the Heisman Trophy, Bob, and then go on to coach a Heisman Trophy winner, in his case, the great Gator quarterback, Danny Werfel. I also know that Coach Spurrier loves to play golf, and appropriately enough, Bob and I will chat with Coach right after this word from Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver. More control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover. The smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin along with my good friend and co-host Bob Bupka. And Bob, it's a real treat for us to welcome in one of the greatest figures in the history of college football. He's the only coach to have the winningest records at two Power 5 programs, those being Florida and South Carolina. He's the head ball coach, Coach Steve Spurrier. Welcome to Musings on Sports.
Thanks, Kelly and Bob. Good to be with you guys today.
Hey, Coach. Bob here. Let me begin. Who first gave you that head ball coach title?
Well, I used to call people that were good coaches a heck of a ball coach, you know, just ball coach. That would seem to be a phrase or a term that I would use occasionally growing up in East Tennessee, whether they coach basketball, football, baseball, track, or whatever. And I remember I always referred to Pat Summitt at Tennessee as one of the best ball coaches there's ever been in Tennessee and probably in the country. So a Gator friend of mine says, well, you must be the head ball coach then, since you use that term ball coach all the time. And so he started it, and it sort of just went around down here at Florida, I guess. And I don't know, ball coach is just a phrase to say somebody's pretty good at it. He does a good job with his players and so forth.
Coach, I gotta ask you, you know, when I think of you and all that you've accomplished, winning the Heisman at UF in '66, winning the national championship at your alma mater, pumping life into a program at South Carolina that really, really needed it. Two words have always kind of come to mind, confidence and belief. I know you're the son of a Presbyterian minister, and I know your parents had a lot to do with your upbringing. Is that where a lot of that confidence and that belief and that competitive fire came from as a young man?
Yeah, I think my dad, a Presbyterian minister, played a little tennis back in high school and so forth, and they said he used to throw his racket when he lost, but anyway, he did not like losing. And I got an older brother, 3 years older than me, and one thing he used to say, if you're keeping score, you're supposed to try your best to win the game. And sometimes I've been accused of winning preseason or exhibition games or bowl games, those college all-star games and stuff like that. And I do have a pretty good record in those games. I have to admit, I can only remember losing one of them. So, I always tell the players, I said, 5, 10, 20 years from now, somebody's going to say, did you win that bowl game out there? And it's a lot nicer to say, yeah, we won that one, instead of saying, no, we lost it. So I think my dad sort of instilled that. And then my high school coaches were like that also, football, basketball, and baseball. Those guys, they taught us to play with, try to our best to win the game. So that was my background right there.
Let me take you back a little bit, Coach, to a field goal you kicked from 40 yards to beat Auburn. Did that really seal the Heisman for you back in 1966?
Yeah, it probably did. A lot of people don't realize I actually kicked a 41-yarder the first game of the season against Northwestern, but we beat those guys like 43-7, so it wasn't that big a deal. And I really just had not attempted one at home since the first game of the season, and this was about the fifth game at home, I guess. And the score happened to be tied when I kicked it. And back in those days, they actually voted before the last game of the season. So we got upset by Miami. They came in to the swamp. We didn't call it the swamp back then, but they came in and beat us 21-16. But they had voted earlier that week, and I had already been named the winner of the Heisman. So, yeah, the field goal probably helped me to win that trophy.
Hey, Coach, I'm going to go off script here, but it's a question that I've been meaning to ask, but I had to find somebody knowledgeable. Why do you think there's no more drop kicks in football?
Yeah, I think Doug Flutie did the last one, didn't he?
He did.
Extra point for New England. Yeah, he and I talk about that a lot because I was a drop kick guy, messing around in high school and college and so forth. And in fact, I used to stand 1 yard from the goalpost and tell somebody, I bet you I can make a 1 yard field goal, which would be the shortest ever. And they said, no way you can do that. And I'd walk down to the end of one pole, so I had a little angle, 1 yard angle, and I could drop kick a 1 yard field goal. So anyway, that was a trick way long time ago.
Hey, Coach, you talked about your upbringing in Johnson City, Tennessee, and playing all three sports. And I understand that even with all the successes that you had on the football field, and they were many, I heard you once say that actually the favorite game, your most favorite game ever as a player, was actually a high school baseball game in 62. How is that right, and how could that be?
Yeah, there were several. We won the state championship in baseball my junior and senior year. Back in those days, there was no classification. So we beat one of the big high schools from Memphis in Nashville my junior year. And then my senior year, we beat the Memphis Christian Brothers High School in Memphis. And I actually pitched both wins against Memphis Christian Brothers. It was double elimination. And I pitched, I think, 15 innings in 3 days. So I had a day in between to rest up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, we won back-to-back state championships. Basketball seems we'd always lose in the region. We'd lose to Kingsport. And then football, we lost a bunch of close games. Had winning records all the time. But baseball was the sport that we seemed to be able to win it all. So as a player, baseball had to be the sport that we won, you know, state championships.
Coach, after your playing career with the 49ers and the Bucks, you got into coaching. Within 5 years, you're the head man at Duke. You had been the offensive coordinator there. I imagine Duke has a warm place in your heart.
I was up there last weekend. My grandson, Gavin Orsberger, graduated in economics in 3 years, and now he's going to go to Fuqua Business School up there next year. He's on the football team. He's a walk-on quarterback. Led his high school in Kentucky to the state championship in football. So we were up there at Duke this past Sunday. Actually, was the graduation ceremonies and so forth. So I guarantee you, though, there wasn't a lot of football fans at the graduation. seems like over 50% of the kids are Asian kids nowadays, and extremely bright young men and women. And but my Gavin Orsberger, he went across the stage, and we got a lot of pictures and so forth. So that was really heartwarming, and it was fun to be there.
Yeah, and Coach, the term airball is one that usually has a lot of negative connotations, but it certainly was one, your time at Duke, of really opening it up and throwing it a lot while you were the head coach. But you also had kind of been given free rein before, a couple of years before, when you were the offensive coordinator. Wasn't that almost a rare opportunity for you to kind of set the stage for your head coaching days?
Yeah, I was very fortunate that I got 1 year at Florida, and the head coach, Doug Dickey, got fired, and Pepper Rogers hired me at Georgia Tech the next year, and he got let go. And the third year, I went and interviewed at Duke University under Coach Red Wilson. He was looking for an offensive coordinator, and I'd met him earlier, and we had played him. Georgia Tech had played Duke, and I guess we did pretty good offensively, and I did call the plays that day. So he hired me as offensive coordinator, and I said, "Do you have a terminology, a playbook I need to learn?" He said, "Nope, it's all yours. Call it whatever you want." So,
wow.
The line coach and I, Eddie Williamson, we got in there and started making up an offense. Simple to learn, and encompassed, you know, five or six good runs, mostly the draw play. If we're going to throw the ball successfully, we got to run that draw play. So we had a couple of winning seasons. The third year there, Ben Bennett at quarterback, we were – I think fourth in the nation in total offense, and that's when I got the head job with the Tampa Bay Bandits in the USFL. So I was down there all 3 years, and then the league folded up, and the Duke job happened to open up in 87, so I had a chance to go back there for 3 years. And then, of course, in 89, we put together a team that won the ACC championship, and then the Florida job was open right after that. So, yeah, I got a special place in my heart for Duke University. They hired me twice when I had no job at all. So I owe a lot to those people up there.
Boy, I bet you do. Coach Steve Spurrier joining us on Musings on Sports. And then your alma mater came calling. Coach, first game, you put 50 points on Oklahoma State September day in 1990. What was that like for you to come out of that tunnel that first day as the head ball coach at Florida, and then to really begin to redraw, to recreate the offense that really hadn't been much more than a ground game for years at Florida?
Yeah, Florida had had talent, but Florida was, well, I guess they're playing like about all the other teams in the SEC. Emmitt Smith, the 3 years he was there, I think he led the conference in rushing maybe every year, but Florida was going 7-5, 7-4, things like that, and lost to Georgia and Auburn every year that he was there, those 3 years. And almost all those guys were back my first year there in 90. The defense, we were loaded. They were third in the nation in total defense year before, and had eight starters coming back. And the offense, we had big, strong offensive linemen. All they did was run the ball the year before. But they could pass block, and we could run the ball. And the receivers were already there. And Shane Matthews was the fifth quarterback when I got there. I didn't know how to line him up. And he didn't even get in the first scrimmage. Four other guys got in. And finally I said, I'd met his dad. His dad said, "Shane loves the offense. He thinks he can play it real well." I said, "Well, he's going to get a chance. I'm sorry I didn't get him in this scrimmage." So finally I kept getting him in. And obviously he had a wonderful spring game. And I gave all the guys a workout for the summer. And Shane went through the workout, and he came back ready to play. And all he did was become the SEC Player of the Year his first year and his second year. And we won the SEC both years, first two times in school history. So the talent was there. And, you know, getting back to that first game, 50-7, I remember one of the big booster guys said, "Steve, we're not going to expect much your first couple of years, but after that, we think we're supposed to be good here at Florida." I said, "Well, let me tell you something. We're going to be good right away. But that third year, I don't know who I was going to play because we had all juniors and seniors the first 2 years. But we were able to recruit some guys, and we did win our division the third year. But that was the year Alabama, Antonio Langham got that pick six, the first ever SEC championship game. So, but anyway, I inherited a bunch of really good players, especially on defense, and the offensive guys were here also. All they needed was a little plan, and like you say, they had to believe we could win the SEC. And that was our goal every year. We talked about it. We didn't just come in and say we're going to have a good team. We set a goal to win the SEC really every year I was here. And I think that's a big reason that you can achieve those things when you believe you can and you want to go get it. So I was fortunate to have all those guys.
Well, we're talking to the legendary Steve Spurrier. He had a lot of great battles with Coach Fulmer at Tennessee over the years. You two are friends today, but your clashes, I think, with Bobby Bowden at Florida State were legendary, including the beatdown of the Seminoles to win the national championship in 96. What was that relationship with Coach Bowden during your days on the field? And I understand the two of you had a special talk not long before Coach passed away.
Yeah, one of Coach Bowden's assistants called me up and said, "Coach Bowden would like to talk to you." They felt like he was going to pass away within a week or so, and he had a list of people he wanted to talk to, and I was one of them, so I was appreciative of that. So I called, talked to him briefly and so forth. You know, they were in the Atlantic Coast Conference, and we were in the SEC. Of course, one of our goals was to beat those guys every year for the state championship. But the main goal we tried to win every year was SEC championship. That doesn't mean we didn't try to beat those guys. We did try. They beat us more than we beat them. And the year we won the national championship, we got the rematch with them because they'd beaten us in the regular season 24-21. But they were just one of many teams. I mean, we had to beat Alabama, Tennessee, Auburn, the other SEC guys, Georgia. Georgia, we sort of had the upper hand on Georgia when I was here in the 90s. But we did have some battles with FSU. They won more than we did, but the one that I guess counted for the most, we were fortunate to win that one.
Hey, Coach, I think Bob and I would be remiss if we didn't ask you about a few of your great quips down through the years. I don't know if they just came to you as a Spurrier of the moment, if you will, but Free Shoes University is the one that everybody talks about based on what happened with FSU and some of their players getting caught in a store. And you can't spell citrus without UT, little jab at Tennessee. Did those lines just kind of come to you?
Those were all told during the summertime. Now, let me tell you what the summertime was down here for the Florida Gator coach. I did between 21 and 22 Gator clubs all over the state, Orlando, Jacksonville, Tampa, and we made a trip down to Key West also just about every year. Key West, Miami, West Palm, and so that's the off season. So we usually play golf, you know, in the afternoon, and then maybe have a beer or two with everybody, and then go to the meeting. And I'm talking to the Gators. I'm not talking to anybody else, and they want to hear something halfway funny. So I thought it was pretty harmless. And when the season started, I didn't tell all those corny jokes, and usually nobody even brought them up during the season. You know, I think I talked about like everybody else talks during the season. But that was just off-season, summertime, and just talking to the Gators, and I can assure you that Bobby Bowden would tell some corny jokes about us, too. It didn't bother me one bit. You never heard me complain about somebody telling jokes on the Gators if they beat us. But anyway, that was just something funny to the Gators. That's all it was.
Hey, Coach, I want to talk to you for a second about your time in Washington as the head coach of the Redskins. I was the statistician for the Redskins radio network during those 2 years. Flew over with you and the team to Osaka for the very first game that you played in Japan when you pretty much thrashed the 49ers. But the totality of those 2 years, it didn't work out. And Daniel Snyder, who continues to be in the news of late for, unfortunately, all the wrong reasons, he hired you in D.C. Coach, did Snyder make it difficult for you to have the kind of success you would hope for in the NFL?
Well, first of all, I did a sorry job. Second of all, I thought I was getting Bobby Beathard, the former general manager that with Joe Gibbs there, won Super Bowls and so forth. He was going to come back, I thought, but dumbass me, I went ahead and signed, and then all of a sudden I was told he wanted too much money, which later I don't think that was the truth. But anyway, long story short, Dan Snyder wanted to be general manager. He wanted to be, sort of like Jerry Jones. He wanted to run the show. So anyway, it didn't work out. And I did a lousy job. But when he started picking the quarterbacks the second year and everybody on the roster, I knew I was finished. But I did a sorry job also. So it was time for me to get out of there.
Yeah, and you did get out of there. You walked away from a lot of money. You had signed a 5-year deal and you were done after two. Ultimately, you took the job at South Carolina. But, Coach, am I understand that you had a call from the folks at Alabama not long after that Redskins experience ended and before you took the job with the Gamecocks?
No, it was afterward, actually. Mal Moore was the AD at Alabama, and he wanted to hire Saban. And, I don't know if y'all know the story. He went down to Miami or talked to him on the phone. I don't know what he did. And Saban turned him down the first time and said, told Mr. Heisinger I'm going to be here. I made a commitment to the Miami Dolphins. And so he calls me up. Mal Moore called me at South Carolina, and he wanted to talk. And I sort of said, Mal, listen, I sort of told these people I'm going to be here. I'm going to try to be the winningest coach in school history. I only got to get to 64 here. If I try to add it all the time, I got to get to 180, I think.
That's where Bear was,
but,
right?
I said, I'm at a place, there's nowhere to go but up in South Carolina. There was nowhere to go but up. I said, Alabama, there's nowhere to go but down. And I just said to Mal Moore, go back and talk to Nick Saban again, and I'll bet you can get him because he really doesn't like pro football. That's not his cup of tea, I don't think. I knew Nick a little bit. Just go back and talk to him again and, whatever you need to say or whatever. So he did. And, of course, Nick changed his mind, and pretty much the rest is history there at Alabama. But it was good for Nick Saban. It was good for me. I needed to stay in South Carolina.
Yeah, were you tempted at all by the possibility of being the coach for the Crimson Tide?
I'm a little different than maybe a lot of people. There's absolutely nothing you could do at Alabama as a coach that hasn't already been done. I think I get my biggest thrill doing something for the first time in school history. And, South Carolina just, winning 11 games, never been done before, finishing in the top 10, winning 4 straight bowl games. We 18 straight home games. Our group owned about all the records there. I wish we'd won just one SEC, and we had the talent to do it. When we had Stephon Gilmore, Jadeveon Clowney, Marcus Lattimore, Alshon Jeffrey, we messed up a few games. We really did, or else we possibly could have won an SEC. So didn't work out, but I had a wonderful time there at South Carolina.
Coach, as we close out the time with you, I'm sure there's many a listener hearing you thinking back to their own coach, whether it was in high school, whether it was in college, that had a big impact on their lives. And I know that Danny Werfel says that the 4 years he spent with you at Florida, where he won the Heisman, guides his life each day. I don't think that a coach can get a higher compliment from a player than a statement like that?
Well, Danny, I tell people all the time, he needs to run for president of the United States, Danny Warfield. A most honest, sincere person, a strong Christian young man. And you talk about believing in the team. Danny won the state championship at his high school in Florida, Fort Walton Beach. They beat St. Thomas Aquinas, a big private school down in Fort Lauderdale, for the state championship. And I happened to watch that game because they held it here at the Swamp in Gainesville. And Danny was sensational. He even had an 80-yard run for a touchdown and a big upset to beat St. Thomas. I said, man, I got to get this guy playing for the Gators because good things happened for him and his team. And the leadership that we had with all those players, especially the quarterback, just, you know, passed on from year to year. And that's why we were really successful all 12 years. Some years a little better than others. But every team won at least 9 games and won at least 6 SEC games. So proud of all these guys that played here. They really attitude was very good and effort was outstanding all 12 years here.
Well, Kelly, before I turn it over to you, Coach, you and your wife, Jerry, have had quite the partnership over the years. It's never easy being the coach's wife, but she is special.
She's the big reason all this has happened, to tell you the truth. We've been married 55 years now and 4 children, 14 grandkids. And she's sort of the glue, I think, that's kept it all together. But when I was head coach all those years, she didn't sit in the press box. She was out in the stands sitting with all the other assistant coaches' wives, kids, and so forth here in Florida and at South Carolina. And she handled the parents and handled everything outside the football office. So, yeah, she as far as camaraderie and team spirit and everybody sort of pulling together, she certainly did more than her part. And I always, you know, that story about every successful man, there's a woman behind every successful man. I say there's a woman beside every successful man, because I know she was just as important in all this as I was. So, yeah, very blessed and fortunate to have her.
Coach Steve Spurrier with us on Musings on Sports. Coach, we're going to wrap this up, but I want to ask you just a couple of questions. Why the visor? I don't know of a whole lot of coaches wearing, football coaches wearing visors, and yours was mostly on your head. Occasionally it might find its way on the ground, but why did you wear the visor early on as opposed to a baseball cap, et cetera?
Yeah, Kelly, I think I wore the visor maybe once or twice at Duke, not a lot. But anyway, when I came down here to Florida, of course, the sunshine is down here, and everybody was wearing visors on the golf course. And I don't think any coaches were wearing a visor on the sideline. Most of them wore hats. And I don't know if you go back to 1990, but most of the SEC coaches wore a coat and tie, you know, sport coat, Coach Stylings, Coach Majors, Pat Dine, all those guys. And so I was sort of the first to just wear a golf shirt. And you know, I read something one time that said there's two ways to be successful in life. You can do it like everybody else does it and try to outwork them, or you can do it differently. So I said, if I can wear that visor, I'm going to be a little bit different. That's going to give me a better chance. So that was just another thing of being a little bit different, like opening the game with a no-huddle offense. We did that all the time, especially here at home. And just, you know, doing something different, I thought was a key to maybe making us a better team down here.
Well, Coach, speaking of different, and I mean this in a very good way, I've heard amazing things about Spurrier's Gridiron Grill in Gainesville. You've got like a half museum, half fantastic restaurant. You must be very proud of putting that all together.
Yeah, we are thrilled at the success we've had. Opened in August and got an excellent chef. Everybody comes in and says, Coach, the food is wonderful. Yeah. And Danny Warfield loaned us his Heisman Trophy, so we got two of them in there. We got a whole bunch of SEC championship footballs, the game balls. Shane Matthews and Chris Doring, they got some of their trophies in there. So we got a lot of trophy case and national championship rings and things of that nature. So, but the food's very good. The people seem to love it there. We got four private rooms you can rent. So you got to go online just to get a reservation right now. So we've been very thrilled at the success we've had thus far. But like anything, you got to keep pushing. You got to keep doing it over and over again. And in fact, I'm heading over there tonight at about 6 o'clock. We've got a dinner, a fundraising dinner for Ronald McDonald House.
So oh, that's great.
So I'm going to do that. Hope raise some money for a lot of charities around this way also.
Hey, well, Coach, if I go into Spurrier's Gridiron Grill wearing a visor, you think I get a free appetizer?
Well, we have a rule that that I can't buy anybody's dinner, and they can't buy my dinner.
I don't like that rule.
Well, what I do, one of the things our general manager, Freddie Wiebe, likes for me to do is blow the whistle and everybody gets quiet and give them a trivia question. You know, like who was the first quarterback at Florida to win SEC championship and things like that. So we throw some trivia questions, give them a $10 free drink ticket card, something like that. I might get you a free $10 drink card. How's that?
Hey, thanks, Coach. I'll take it.
Okay.
Hey, Coach, final question for you was, and maybe it's an obvious one, was the 96 championship, was that the pinnacle for you, certainly as a coach? Was there anything that could top that, and particularly beating Florida State to win it all?
No, I don't look at it that way. I really don't. We were very fortunate that year. I don't know if you know that we lost the last game of the year up there at Tallahassee, 24-21. Both of our starting offensive linemen were out, but they came back for the national championship game. But we had to have five games go our way to win the national championship after losing the last game of the season. Ohio State had to go beat Arizona State in Rose Bowl. That happened. Texas had to upset Nebraska in that Big 12 championship. All we had to do was beat Alabama and FSU after all these things happened to win the national championship. So I know we had a lot of help along the way. And I know winning those SECs, I'm sort of a guy, if you win your conference championship over and over again, I think you do a pretty dang good job. Bobby Stoops and Bobby's just got one national championship, but he's got 10 Big 12 championships. He and I, we share one goal that we really, really like. He won more conference championships than home losses in his 18 years there. And we won more SEC championships than home losses my 12 years here in Florida. So, you know, things like that, the consistency overall factor, I just think those are so much bigger than, okay, one year it just happened to all come together. But those guys that do it year after year, Bill Self at Kansas, I think he's one of the best basketball coaches in the nation because he wins his conference championship almost every year. Almost every year he's been there. So anyway, that's just the way I see things. It was the biggest championship, and maybe the fans celebrate it more than the conference ones. But me as a coach, if your guys, you know, give it their best effort, all the way through, and you got a conference championship, maybe that national just didn't work out, that's okay. Go after it the next year.
Well, I appreciate your time, Coach, and I'm going to leave you with one thing. Put me in, Coach. I don't smoke.
Okay. I don't see many smokers nowadays around, fortunately. All right, good talking to you guys.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Kelly Elbin back here with Bob Bupka to close out this episode of Musings on Sports. Bob, Coach Spurrier, he is the very definition of a winner. His accomplishments as a player, as a coach, as I said, he's easily one of the greatest figures ever in college football history.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And his warm personality, how he cares for his players, how he cares for his fellow coaches, certainly came through in that interview. And I'll make a rather bold statement. I think that no matter where you are, if somebody throws in a visor and nobody's under it, everybody's going to say, where's Coach Berea?
I love it. I love it. Well, it was great. We appreciate Coach's time very much. A reminder to join us next week. Bob and Janice will be on the road at the PGA Championship at Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa. Our guest will be Bob Herrig. Bob's a good buddy of ours from SI.com and Morning Read. And Bob is the author of a new book, Tiger and Phil. Bob Bupka, we've got a whole lot to talk about with our buddy Bob Herrig.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Should be a wonderful book. I've spoken to some people that have read part of it, and they're really enjoying it. Hey, if you can't write a good book about Tiger and Phil, you better get out of the book writing business.
That's exactly right. Also encourage everyone to please, and this is a selfish plug, check out my Monday Musings on my Facebook page. That's the Kelly Elpin Facebook page that everybody wants to get to. And also, whether it's Coach Spurrier this week, Bob Herrig next week, or any of our archived Musings on Sports, you can always listen to them wherever you enjoy your podcasts. To my good friend Bob Bupka, Kelly Elpin signing off, Musings on Sports.